Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We'd like to better understand who is listening and how you are using podcasts. Please help us out. Complete a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcast survey. One word, podcast survey. It takes less than 10 minutes. It will really help to support the show. Again, npr.org/podcast survey. In the mid-1990s, sports teams didn't get any bigger than the Chicago Bulls. Led by super mega star Michael Jordan, the Bulls won 6 NBA championships in 8 years. And now, ESPN is presenting a 10-part documentary series all about them.
The Last Dance follows the Bulls' final championship season, and it dips back into history to look at how the dynasty was made. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls and ESPN's new documentary series, The Last Dance, on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Also with us, you know, we sat and we thought, who do we know who has Michael Jordan opinions? And there was only one answer with us from NPR's Code Switch, our friend Gene Demby. Hi, Gene.
What's good, y'all?
I missed you so much, buddy.
Good to be here.
So just for a little bit of background, this documentary series is directed by Jason Hare. He's a filmmaker who's made a bunch of other sports documentaries and other stuff. And it's not like the OJ documentary or some of the other 30 for 30s, which aren't really just about the sport. They're about something else. This is really super about basketball. Steven, are you a big NBA guy?
I went through a stretch of being a big NBA guy kind of in the late 90s and early aughts when the Milwaukee Bucks were finally seeming to be relevant again. So I've drifted in and out of the NBA, basically depending on whether Wisconsin basketball is hugely relevant. but I have a kind of a long history of hating basketball dynasties. I deeply hated the LA Lakers in the early aughts. But time heals most wounds, unless you're Michael Jordan, in which case all of your grudges remain 100% intact, which is one of the things that we've learned from this show.
Yeah, one of the things I think is amazing is, like, I didn't find the show to be particularly pro or anti Michael Jordan. It spends a lot of time trying to, like, explain just how dominant he was in terms of basketball.
Sure.
But it's not necessarily devoted to making you like him, in part because, as Steven said, you spend so much time hearing him talk about all the people he is or was mad at. Most of his major victories he chalks up to having been really ticked off at somebody. And so therefore I had to go and prove to them that they couldn't push me around or whatever, like anybody was trying to push around Michael Jordan.
I mean, we've seen 8 episodes of the 10 episode series. They've only aired 4. And the two takeaways that I wrote down is, like, the overarching theme of the 8 episodes of this show. One is that Michael Jordan is a creature fueled almost entirely by spite. And two, that spite is incredibly exhausting. And so you get a sense of just how punishing this experience was for him, how exhausting, how tiring, how at the end of one of these seasons, he would have just given so much to just the experience of getting these victories. You get a sense of how unhappy that would make somebody, how difficult this person's life would be, just how tiring it would be to be Michael Jordan at this time.
Yeah, Gene, where are you in terms of, you know, watching this show and Michael Jordan opinions? Like, have you learned anything new from it? Is it really just reiterating your Michael Jordan opinions?
So I should say that my Michael Jordan opinions have evolved a lot since I was a teenager. My very first basketball game was when I was like 5 or 6 years old. My mom took me to the Spectrum to see this rookie named Michael Jordan. Of course, I was 5 or 6 years old. I didn't know what the hell was going on. But I didn't become like a huge basketball fan until his little interregnum, like when he took his time off, because as Stephen said, he burned out. And so there was this giant Michael Jordan-shaped hole in the basketball landscape, right, when he wasn't playing. And so even though that was when I fell in love with basketball, like, deeply, and he wasn't around, like, I had a picture of Michael Jordan on my wall, like, mid-flight doing the dunk from the dunk contest. But, like, I had never actually seen any of that. Like, it was just, like, the mythology was so embedded in our sports culture that he was just like this figure that hovered over basketball, even though he wasn't in it anymore until he came back. And then, of course, I was like completely obsessed with him when he came back, because it's like, oh, I felt like I had been robbed of the chance to see him, you know, at the top of his ability. And so he came back for the second three-peat and I was obsessed.
Yep.
But the problem now, like, I just have my politics are like actually grown up politics. And so, like, so much of the stuff that I loved about Michael Jordan when I was you know, 15, 16 years old, it's stuff that I find, like, reprehensible about him now, you know? Like, I mean, he feels like almost like an avatar for toxic masculinity in a lot of ways. Like, he nursed all these grudges. He was hypersensitive in this way that always resulted in, like, sort of just anger. The other thing that's sort of weird about him is that he's also charming, too. Like, mm-hmm. like in a way that I don't think we ever got to see at the height of his fame in the 90s, right? Because so much of what we saw was this really, like, meticulously, like, manicured image of him, right? He never says anything offensive. Everything he says is sort of bland. He was, like, a really boring interview. And here, he actually seems like a person with, like, you know, feelings about things. And, like, there's one point in the series when which he cries. And even though he cries about people taking issue with the fact that he was a bully, he's defending his right to bully people. I mean, obviously, Michael Jordan crying is, like, a whole meme, and we all know this. But it's still fascinating that he, like, is a human being, because we literally, he never seemed like anything other than this perfect avatar of, like, of athletic excellence for so long, you know?
Yeah. It was interesting to me to see the contrast between, like, on the one hand, he was so popular and loved, but on the other hand, as Steven said, he was finding the whole thing really exhausting, and it seemed like he was trapped between wanting to be the most famous, like enjoying the fact that he was like the most famous person in the world, as they show Oprah saying at one point, and it's probably true at the time she says it. But at the same time, like just wanting out of the whole thing and feeling resentful and angry all the time. And I couldn't decide, like every time you see him give that explanation of like, the reason I went out so hard against this team is that their coach didn't greet me in a restaurant. Every time you hear something like that, it's like, is it more interesting whether he actually needs that kind of spite to be great? Or is it more interesting if he just thinks he does? And I don't know which is the answer. Like, if he couldn't find something to focus on that was a personal grudge, would that actually impede his basketball game? Or did he just convince himself at some point that that was the case? And how did he convince himself of that? And how do you coach that? But I also appreciated the fact that as much as it is about Michael Jordan, it is also sometimes about other people besides Michael Jordan. And one of the things I think they want to stress is that no matter how dominant and good you are, you actually do need a team around you in order to win championships. Because one of the storylines that they go into early on is Scottie Pippen being kind of jerked around by the Bulls before this last season. And he decides he's going to have surgery on his foot at the beginning of the season instead of in the offseason, which means he misses a bunch of games where he didn't necessarily have to. And Jordan is really mad and is like, he left me out there like dangling on my own. But it's like, that's the point he was making. The point he was making was that he was necessary and they were treating him like he wasn't necessary. Michael Jordan at that time was kind of trying to bigfoot the Bulls about Phil Jackson and keeping Phil Jackson, the coach, because he loved him. But like, he could have been bigfooting the Bulls to please and satisfy and pay Scottie Pippen, who was stuck in this terrible contract. And it's like, why weren't you throwing your weight around to get Scottie Pippen paid if, in fact, you were going to be up a creek if he went and got surgery? Gene, am I right?
Absolutely. Oh, my God. This made me so mad. Like, Scottie Pippen was the 122nd highest paid player in the NBA that season, right? At that point, he was clearly like one of the six or seven best players in the NBA, right? He lauded Scottie Pippen. He's like, I couldn't have had my career, the career I had without Scottie Pippen. But also, like, that's all fine and good. Like, Scottie Pippen was from a very poor family, and he was trying to get compensated for his, you know, his talent. And Michael Jordan's opinion would have mattered more than anything. And this is sort of the one of the reasons that a lot of people, especially sort of the more politically minded athletes, have always disliked Michael Jordan, right? It's because he wasn't like necessarily a pro-labor guy. He wasn't necessarily like the most outspoken on issues of race. Obviously, like, part of the big story of Michael Jordan's celebrity is that he was the most famous person in the world, and he was this sort of apolitical black African-American man. Like, he never spoke out on anything. One of his teammates, and this is a teammate we don't actually hear from, Craig Hodges, was a really outspoken critic of, you know, United States imperialism. He was like a black nationalist, and he played for the Bulls. And so he was always pushing Michael Jordan, like, look, you are in a unique position to like say all sorts of stuff about any number of things. And, you know, Michael Jordan famously said, Republicans buy sneakers too. And so he wouldn't throw his weight behind a candidate who was running in his native North Carolina, a black candidate who was running in native North Carolina against a racist. They don't really press him in this documentary on that kind of stuff, which is, I wish they would have, because the Republicans buy sneakers too thing had always been, people had always suggested it was apocryphal, But this documentary sort of makes clear that he actually said that. So, like, one of the sort of fascinating things about this documentary, I wish they would sort of drill down on a lot, was that, like, there's always this tension between him, like, as a virtuoso and fitting in with other people. And he was the best player in the league, and he has sort of had to learn how to play with other people and, like, be a good teammate. But it seems like he never really, like, really did. It felt like he's bucking against every attempt to make him, like, a more generous and thoughtful teammate.
Right. Stephen, what do you think?
Yeah, I think one of the overarching points that this documentary makes is that, you know, Michael Jordan was in the league for, what, 7-8 years before they won their first championship. And one of the reasons that Phil Jackson was installed as the coach is that he had a plan to distribute the ball beyond just Michael Jordan. And one thing that I think this documentary does really well is tell that larger story and weave in the stories of people like Scottie Pippen and Dennis Rodman and the people without whom these championships weren't possible, because Michael Jordan was the best player in the NBA for years, had scoring titles, and did not win a championship. The book on Michael Jordan for years and years was, he can't win a championship. We've seen that since with people like LeBron James. Like, LeBron James is the best player in basketball, but he can't win in Cleveland with this supporting cast. And so we haven't necessarily talked much about the structure of The Last Dance as a piece of documentary filmmaking. It is trying to pull off a very complicated bit of chronology. Basically, the story is moving on two parallel tracks, right? There was this film crew that had pretty unprecedented access in that sixth championship season, 1997 and 1998. And along the way, we are getting the story of that season. And at the same time, chronologically, it's constantly skipping backward and telling another chronological story, which is the history of Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls. And so that's really a pretty tricky and impressive bit of documentary filmmaking. As much as it's important to talk about Michael Jordan, I think this show does a really nice job of weaving in the other stories that go into this picture.
Yeah, I want to talk about Dennis Rodman, because Dennis Rodman came to the Bulls from the Pistons, which... Man, if you think that one iota of the contempt that the Bulls of that time had for the Pistons of that time has evaporated, it has not. They still hate Isaiah Thomas in particular so much. And the documentary filmmaker, like, Hare is still having so much fun kind of playing the things that Jordan says and then the things that Thomas says, and then kind of giving you some evidence of who might be full of it as between these two guys. But Rodman came from the Pistons, and Rodman in a bunch of different ways. If you've seen, like, Dennis Rodman at the time, he started off like the whole thing where he dyed his hair and all that business and became like, now I'm dating Madonna and all that kind of stuff, wasn't like necessarily there at first. He had this moment where he seemed to kind of transform into his final form. Gene, what are your Dennis Rodman thoughts?
That I thought, like, the Dennis Rodman stuff is so fascinating. Like, here's this dude who is like, this is like 1996. Is like, you know what I mean? He's like playing at sort of like queer presentation, right? There's a scene in this documentary in which Barbara Walters is sitting down and she's like, the tattoos, the hats, the hair. What are they about?
Are the, like, tattoos masking pain?
Exactly. Right. Is this about trauma? Like, it's like, what are you talking about? Like, it's just like the most simplistic way of, like, thinking about these things. But, like, Dennis Rodman was doing this weird high wire act. One of the things that always comes across in any interviews with him is that he's, like, really, really, really shy. Like, if he's going to be on the most famous team in the world, right, playing with the most famous person in the world, like, then part of the thing he had to do was, like, lean all the way into, like, a character, sort of, because he couldn't be, like, just this, like, soft-spoken dude from the country, you know? But his story is like, you know, outside of, like, the I'm dating Carmen Electra and Michael Jordan had to come grab me out
of a
Las Vegas out of a Las Vegas hotel after I was binging for 48 hours is the stuff of, like, a sort of hokey sports movie, like, in and of itself. Like, I'm a homeless kid who, like, finds myself on a tiny little college basketball team, and then I shoot up 7 inches in the summer and I suddenly become, like, this little phenom. It's like, that stuff is like the stuff of sports movies. And it, because Michael Jordan's story is, like, overpowers everything, it's almost like you almost wish that there was, like, a little bit more space for Dennis Rodman. Even the Dennis Rodman episode sort of becomes a Michael Jordan episode. And I wish there was, like, a little bit more time sort of we spent with Dennis Rodman, sort of his, like, his very particular brain, which works in a way that doesn't seem to, like, other people. He's like, you know what? I'm just going to rebound, which is, like, the least glamorous thing you can do in basketball. He's like, you know what? I'm going to rebound.
And I think they make a good case that he really provided a missing piece of that as the Bulls were trying to kind of pull that team together. Mm-hmm. You know, you get all that interesting stuff about Rodman, but he's also one of the few people who was like, I don't care what Michael Jordan thinks.
I just wanted to say, I mean, one of the things that really jumps out about the experience of this show in total is just how much access they have. They really managed to get footage of just about everything and interviews with just about everyone. I mean, in the first two episodes of this show, you have two U.S. presidents interviewed. You have Bill Clinton in the Scottie Pippen episode, and you have, quote, former Chicago resident Barack Obama.
That was awesome.
In other episodes. I mean, you could do an episode of this show just talking about Bob Costas's hair and how, yes, and how it evolves over the course of his career. You can smell the disgusting cigars in so many episodes of this show. They just really managed to cobble together so much footage of so many people. It is, I think, extremely well done, and it could not be coming out at a better time.
Yeah, I think there are like 10 different things in this 10-part series that could have been their own 10-part series.
Absolutely.
There is a ton here. And again, I cannot wait to see the end, even though I know what happens. That series is called The Last Dance. It's been airing on ESPN. There are 10 parts, and it's airing on Sundays. You can find it, you know, on demand, or you can just keep up with it every week. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. Tell us what you thought about it. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What's Making Us Happy This Week. So come right back.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message come from APM with the podcast Terrible, Thanks for Asking. In each episode, Nora McInerney explores the real human stories behind the things people don't often like to talk about, like addiction, loss, and trauma. USA Today calls it a warm, tear-stained hug, and the New York Times says it's a gift to be able to listen. Find Terrible, Thanks for Asking wherever you listen to podcasts. This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as isolation, depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment when you need professional help. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit betterhelp.com/happyhour to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What's making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, one of my jobs at NPR Music in post-quarantine life has been to keep an eye on and chronicle the various songs that people have written about what it's like to be cooped up in our houses. And I wanted to call attention to a song called House Party. It is by New Kids on the Block with Naughty by Nature, Boys to Men, and Big Frida, as well as like Jordan Sparks pops up in it. And my immediate reaction about 30 seconds into the video for this song was, and I quote, "Oh, cheerful stupidity, how I've missed you."
Stay inside now, we're gonna turn the lights down. Don't you wanna let your feelings go?
There are so many glum, dour ballads about how sad and hard it is to be cooped up. And of course, how sad and hard this time in the life of the world is. It is a difficult time. But to just to see like Donnie Wahlberg and Boys to Men and Big Frida and the members of Naughty by Nature, and like in the video, like Kid and Play shows up, Ken Jeong shows up in the video, just to see this flurry of idiocy and just like so much like 1991 retro goofiness. I just sat there like, fine, this is great. So I do recommend it. That's House Party by New Kids on the Block, Boys to Men, Naughty by Nature, Big Frida, Jordan Sparks, and just everybody else in the world.
A cast of thousands. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week?
So like a lot of people, I've been very, very starved for sports content, which is why I love this Michael Jordan series. So I've been watching a lot of SB Nation's Beef History. I don't know if you've ever seen Beef History. There are these very funny, very sharply reported deep dives on high-profile sports figures and sometimes institutions and sports figures who could not stand each other. And these are not, like, about rivalries like Michael Jordan and Isaiah Thomas, because a rivalry implies some kind of, like, you know, symmetry and standing or ability. This is beef history, so this is about, like, naked contempt. Sometimes it's very petty things, sometimes it's big things. In the case of, like, Lance Armstrong and Greg LeMond. LeMond was a pioneering U.S. cyclist whose reputation was ruined because he suggested, before anyone else was willing to pay attention, that Lance Armstrong, you know, cancer survivor, global celebrity, was a cheater. It turns out Lance Armstrong was a cheater. Sometimes it's about pettier stuff. And sometimes it's about something that's, like, a little bit petty and a little bit serious. Serena Williams and Maria Sharapova. Serena Williams, obviously, is the greatest tennis player ever. But up until pretty late in her career, she was wildly out-earned monetarily by Maria Sharapova, who Serena also destroyed every time they played each other.
Yep, there's all sorts
of stuff in there about race and beauty. But also some of the reason they didn't like each other because they might have dated the same dude. So, like, so yeah, I mean, I like one of the things I miss most about sports is not just like the highlights and the scores, but just like the psychosocial stuff it, like in it, all the drama. So yeah, check out Beef History if you haven't already. It's a lot of fun.
All right. I love it. Beef History. Thank you very much, Gene Demby. I went back and forth about what I wanted to talk about today, but ultimately, what can I talk about other than the Stephen Sondheim 90th birthday concert that was on YouTube on Sunday night, and it remains up on YouTube in case you missed it. There have been several Stephen Sondheim tribute concerts that have aired in different places on PBS and all that stuff. This one, obviously, was done while people are at home. So what you have is a series of basically people who have filmed themselves singing Stephen Sondheim songs at home in their houses, often in their bathrooms, because stars love how they sound singing in the bathroom. The one that really blew everybody away the most, the one that I would say started the most conversation, was a clip that is either a Zoom call or is made to look like a Zoom call of Meryl Streep, Christine Baranski, and Audra McDonald singing Ladies Who Lunch while lounging around in their bathrobes and drinking.
Wow.
But there's also, like, Raul Esparza sings, Mandy Patinkin sings. At the very end, Bernadette Peters sings a cappella in her bathroom with, like, these candles behind her that are exactly what you would think would be in Bernadette Peters' bathroom. So, very, very good. Loved it. The Sondheim 90th birthday concert. You can look it up on YouTube. And that is what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Steven at I Dislike Steven. And you can find Gene at GD215. So good to have you back, buddy. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And our producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, is your quarantine music to bob your head to as you listen to the podcast. Thanks to both of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second and you're so inclined, subscribe to our newsletter. It's at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. Listen to Gene on Code Switch. And another reminder to take the podcast survey at npr.org/podcast survey. That's one word, podcast survey. And we will see you all back here next week, where we will be talking about the Netflix series Dairy Girls.
Hey, it's Guy Raz from NPR's How I Built This. And each week on the show during this unprecedented crisis, I'll be asking some of the top founders and builders how they're dealing with the economic impact of the coronavirus and hear about some of the ways they're pivoting to fight it. Subscribe or listen now to How I Built This.